On Sunday, March 4th, 2007, a television special entitled The Lost Tomb of Jesus aired nationwide on the Discovery Channel. Those who produced the special argued that 10 small bone boxes, called ossuaries, were discovered in 1980 in the Jerusalem suburb of Talpiot, and they supposedly held the remains of Jesus of Nazareth and his family members. This assumption was based on the six names found in the tomb, including Jesus, son of Joseph, who supposedly refers to Jesus of Nazareth, Maria, supposedly Jesus' mother Mary, Matthias or Matthew, although not a family member of Jesus, supposedly a relative of Mary, Mariamne y Mara, which supposedly refers to Mary Magdalene, who supposedly was married to Jesus, Yehuda or Judas, son of Jesus, who, although not mentioned in the New Testament, is supposedly the son of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and Joseph, who supposedly refers to one of Jesus' brothers, Joses. The assertion that the odds are 600 to 1 that the Talpiot tomb is the tomb of Jesus rests on the assumption that the people named in this tomb are the family members of Jesus. But scholars say there's a problem with attributing any of these names to Jesus' family. First, the name Jesus is far from certain. Some scholars think it is a totally different name. If the first name is not Yeshua or Jesus, then this whole new radical theory collapses. Second, there is no indication that the Mary mentioned is Jesus' mother. Third, Matthew is not part of Jesus' family. Fourth, there is no evidence that Mariamne y Mara refers to Mary Magdalene. Fifth, there is no mention in the New Testament that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene or anyone else. Sixth, there is no mention in the New Testament that Jesus had a son. Seventh, if you were Jesus of Nazareth, would you really name your son Judas? Eighth, Joseph should be vocalized Joseph, who then could not be Jesus' brother mentioned in Mark 6:3 and Mark 15:40. Ninth, the so-called James ossuary, which was assumed to have come from the Talpiot tomb, was photographed and in circulation in the 1970s before the Talpiot tomb was ever discovered. But there is even more evidence that shows the Talpiot tomb is not the real tomb of Jesus of Nazareth. To share that evidence with us, our guest today is Dr. Daryl Bach, research professor of New Testament studies at Dallas Theological Seminary. He is one of the leading New Testament scholars in the world and was asked by Ted Koppel be one of the guest scholars to critique the Discovery Channel special after it aired. We invite you to join us today on the John Ankerberg Show and learn why the family tomb of Jesus is a story full of major holes, false assumptions, and false facts. Welcome to our program. We're talking about the Lost Tomb of Jesus that was a Discovery Channel special, and it postulated a radical theory, namely that they have found the bones of Jesus of Nazareth in a family tomb in the suburbs of Jerusalem in Talpiot. And here to discuss the assumptions for this radical theory is Dr. Daryl Bach, who is a leading scholar across the world, acknowledged by Christians and non-Christians. In fact, he was asked by Ted Koppel to appear after the Discovery Channel aired their special in a show that critiqued the historical accuracy of the assumptions that were in the special. Daryl, we're glad that you're here. We want to come back to the statistics. The basis for them saying this was Jesus' family tomb was the fact that they found six names, James would be seven, that they claim are either mentioned in the New Testament, and they all refer to Jesus' family. But, let's talk about the names, who they were. First of all, you have Jesus, son of Joseph. You've got Maria, Matthew, Mariamne y Mara, Judas, son of Jesus, and Joseph, who are all found in this tomb. And let's start with a little bit of what we said last week of why these names do not constitute what the folks in the special were claiming.
Well, several of the names either don't have any evidence for being a part of Jesus' family, either from the New Testament or outside of it. Or or there are questions about the associations that have been made. There are four that are basically non-starters. You've got your James ossuary, ossuary number 10, which was a plain ossuary found in the tomb. But obviously the James ossuary has an inscription on it. So either
And it's also decorated.
That's right. So if the James ossuary is not authentic, if the actual inscription isn't authentic, then it doesn't count. And if it is authentic, it doesn't count.
And you had just lunch with Professor Cloner, who was the original archaeologist on this, and he said the dimensions don't match.
That's right. We were in his living room actually in one evening, and he actually showed me his original notes and everything. So that name's a non-starter. Matthew's a non-starter, not a member of the family. Mariamne Imara is a non-starter because there's no way to connect her to Mary Magdalene, and the suggestion that Jesus is married has no evidence in it. And once you do that, then you lose Judah, son of Jesus, because if it's a son of Jesus, it's not a son of Jesus of Nazareth, it's a son of Jesus of Talpiot.
Right. Let's talk, before we go on, let's talk about Mariamne Imara. We've got two friends, basically, Tal Alon, and we got Dr. Stephen Fong, president of the University of Holy Land. And both of them were used in the special and came out with a different take on Mariamne Imara. Want to talk about that?
Yeah, let's talk about Tal Alon for a second because she's important to this discussion. She is the woman who cataloged all the names in this period. So all our statistics that we know about names and how frequent they are come from her study, which everyone uses around the world. In fact, the book is affectionately known in the scholarly world as the phone book. And so she has come out and said with regard to this inscription, it's one person and one person only. Whereas Stephen Fahn has come out and said, well, no, I think there are two hands here and it could well be two names that we had one name to begin with and then another one was added later. This is going to continue to be debated. I think is the long and short of it, although my own take is that if you actually look at the inscriptions, that Tal Alon may have a little better of the case here and that we're only dealing with one person.
So what does Mariamne Imara then mean?
It would mean that Mariamne is her name. By the way, this is a Greek name. It's not a Hebrew name. Every other inscription in here is Hebrew. Mary is from Migdal in the region of Galilee. Galilee is considered to be one of the least Hellenized areas of the Judea-Galilean region, and so what is she doing with a Greek name? And then the second name probably means miss. It's a roundabout way of a term of respect, a way of qualifying who she is. Although the special claim that it means master and that it shows that she had a key role. But to do that, you've got to read a Greek name with an Aramaic name, and you've got to be pretty sophisticated to pick that up.
Or another way of saying it is, why are you translating it in Aramaic when it was written in Greek? Because it doesn't mean that in Greek. They're just importing a meaning. It'd be like saying, well, this is what it means in Russian. The fact is it has nothing to do with this tomb.
Yeah, it involves in some way some kind of a transliteration, and you're sitting here going, why would you do this? Why would you have someone with a Greek name having an Aramaic nickname? Now, you could say, oh, it's a bilingual culture. Yeah, but then the question becomes, then why isn't the inscription in Semitic like all the other ones? So, it, what you find at every step with this special is that virtually every step has an if in it. And almost all the ifs have to line up and all the dots connect before you can even entertain the theory. But the problem is that several of these dots are questionable. So if you start erasing dots, you can't connect them.
In other words, you're saying, okay, four or at least three out of the six are non-starters. They shouldn't be there at all. And if they import James in there, that's a fourth one that shouldn't be in there because the bone boxes don't match.
And all of a sudden, your six or seven names are really down to three. And the fact is that the three that you're left with are very, very common names. You're Joseph, Mary, and Jesus.
All right. One of the other things that was brought up is the fact is the way they sneak the James bones box back into the Talpiot tomb, as they say, the patina, the substance on the outside of the tomb, matches the grave.
Yes, a patina is a soot layer, if you want to think about that, that is laid on the stone as it sits there over time. And you can analyze that chemically. But many archaeologists suggest that the patina of a given region will be pretty stable across several tombs and several areas. So the idea that you have patina matching only shows that you've got a geographical regional match as opposed to a specific locale match.
Another thing that was brought up, it was the chevron, the decoration on the tomb and some of the inscriptions or the writings on the bone boxes themselves. And they gave a meaning to that, but you talked with Kloner and some of the others in Israel while you were there. What did you find out?
Well, this chevron sign, which is sort of this circle and this kind of half start of a triangle or whatever, that we see that the special suggested was a Christian symbol for resurrection. How they know that, I have no idea. I'm not aware of that symbol being used with that meaning anywhere. But anyway, this symbol has been taken in one of two ways. It either is a lid locator or some type of a handle indicator. That is a non-symbolic interpretation of what it is. That comes from some of the experts. And then other experts have said, no, this actually is a symbol for the temple, in the presence of God in the temple. And that we have, Ben Witherington mentioned to me, he has pictures of Caiaphas's ossuary in which this symbol is present. And if that's the case, in association with the temple, it simply identifies a Jewish burial box.
Yeah, neither one has a secret meaning.
That's right.
All right. Go on to the DNA evidence. They analyzed the evidence of two of the ossuaries and not the other ossuaries that were there. This was brought up by Ted Koppel in the special that you appeared with him on. Talk about that.
Well, it was the first question Ted Koppel asked them when he was on. In fact, when he asked it, I was in the green room because I was on the second segment, and I turned to the other people who are going to be on the panel with me, and I said, he's not wasting any time. This was a very direct question. Why test just the two boxes when you could have tested the whole lot and you could have solved a lot of problems real quickly? And the answers, very sheepishly given, was, well, we did the best we could with what we had at the time. And if you had all the ossuaries and potentially all the biological matter there, remember there are no bones left in these boxes. All that was left was the box and any biological residue. They could have tried to have made that test and they didn't. And what they ended up getting out of that test was very, very minimal. It was a non-match, which is what you would expect. I have a pastor friend of mine who said, it's a little bit like taking the DNA of you and the person sitting next to you in church. What would you expect? You'd expect a non-match.
It also it gives a whole different slant on their theory. This may actually show it's not a family tomb if all the people aren't connected.
That's true. If you were to do a test and all the family and every ossuary was to be a different DNA, then you would show that you weren't dealing with a family tomb. And of course, we just don't know because they didn't run the tests. And so the point here is that the process of the claim and proving the claim was a very incomplete process, a very inadequate process.
After the special that you appeared with Ted Koppel on, you flew to Israel. You've been teaching at Ben-Gurion University. You had dinner with Professor Kloner, and you met Tal Alon. You talked with Stephen Fong and so on. But there's also something that happened that you were putting on your website, some of these comments coming back, and also one of your friends sent you some information on statistics that made their expert on statistics come out with a new statement. And when we come right back, Daryl's going to tell us all about that. All right, back. We're talking with Dr. Daryl Bach, who's one of the world's leading New Testament scholars. He appeared on the Discovery Channel special with Ted Koppel to critique the special and give his historical analysis. And one of the things that happened when you were talking with Ted Koppel is that he brought up Andre Feuerberger, the statistician from University of Toronto, and asked a question. And you thought it was a good question, and then things happened after the program. I want you to tell us about that.
Well, the gist of the question was, on what basis were these statistics compiled? And the gist of the response was, well, I basically took the assumptions that were given to me and plugged in the numbers. And, of course, the issue here is, how do you plug in the numbers and whether the assumptions, in fact, work? I had someone after the special who did math write my blog because the public vetting was happening on the blog. And question these numbers and also send the same statistics to Feuerberger for his assessment. And Feuerberger then issued a qualification on the point that he made on the special.
And I've got that. He says, it is not the purview of statistics to conclude whether or not this tomb site is that of the New Testament family. Any such conclusion much more rightfully belongs to the purview of biblical historical scholars like yourself, who are in a much better position to assess the assumptions entering into the computations. And that's the key line, assessing the assumptions before you put them into the computer.
Exactly right. And so what Jim Tabor's tried to work his way around this by saying, well, the reason the statistics are valuable is they show us the value of these cluster of names. What's the likelihood that you get this cluster of names from a single tomb? We don't have any other cluster like it in anything else that we've found already, which is true. But the problem here is that you've got to do the name and person association in order to have those numbers have any value. And so when you go through and you question the fact that several of these names don't plug in, or it's very unlikely that they'll plug in fact, several of them are non-starters, all of a sudden your statistics that are built on six or seven names shrinks down to three, and those names are so common that you don't have a problem. Mary, one out of every five people, females at the time, is named Mary. Joseph, one out of ten, just about, of every male is named Joseph. It's the second most popular male name. Mary's the most popular female name. Jesus, the sixth most popular male name. One out of about 15 or 16 people is named Jesus. So these are very common names that we're left with when it's all said and done. You take a population of 80,000, 16,000 of them are going to be named Mary. 6,400 of them are going to be named Joseph. 4,800 of them are going to be named Judah, the name of the supposed name of the son. 3,200 of them are going to be named Jesus, and 1,600 of them are going to be named Matthew. Those are all the names represented. So that's a lot of folks crawling around who eventually end up in boxes because people die.
Yeah, this isn't a case of the fact of, can we match this cluster of names in another grave? And so we got a match, okay? That might be possible. In fact, you need to talk about some of the other tombs that have come up with a lot of those names. But this is really a case of, before we start saying this is the family of Jesus, we've got to give evidence that shows this is the family.
Exactly right. And the problem here is that at several points we don't match, and so we can't even get to the statistics. That's the point. We can't get to the statistics. We can't plug in the names for the numbers, because the names themselves don't qualify to be worthy of being plugged in for the numbers.
The fact is that, let's talk also about the fact there's something else that clouds the statistics, and that is something I heard in your interview with Professor Cloner, and that was the number of bodies that he thought were actually in this grave.
Yes, if you take the average find, the average find has 1.75 bodies per ossuary. Now that's a little bit like saying average American family has 2.3 members. That the point here is that some of them have three, some of them have two, some of them have one. You know, and so
let me explain what you're saying. You're saying that every ossuary there could be different members, two, three, four, in the same bone box.
Absolutely,
which
right.
We found in Caiaphas's bone box.
Exactly. So the point here is that Cloner estimates, and this is an estimate because we don't know if every tomb is an average tomb, but he's suggesting there could be as many as 35 bodies in that tomb, which means the DNA tests that you do are problematic because you don't know whether you're testing the body that's named on the ossuary or you're testing an unnamed body that's in the ossuary.
Yeah, Craig Evans at Acadia Divinity School said that there are 18 bodies found in the ossuaries and 17 on the shelves of the floor. In actuality, from actually what the people saw, there was 13.
Correct.
So you've got 13 instead of 9 or 10, and the fact is this also impacts your statistics.
It does. And again, it introduces another variable. And so the problem here is that it's a little bit like juggling balls. You got all these balls going at a time. Well, the more balls you add to the juggle, the less likely the juggler is going to be able to juggle the balls.
Another thing is that there were only 6 inscriptions where we actually had names out of the 10, and if there were 13 bodies, that means we had 6 that we knew about, and we got 7 that you know nothing about.
Exactly right. And so the possibility is, let's say Mariamne isn't a biological match with 7 or 8 males in that tomb. Which one is she married to? And of course, we also have the problem of, think about this for a second. Mary Magdalene being married to Jesus and having a child. She's got to have that child by Jesus before he's crucified. And not only that, she's traveling with him. So how is she going to keep that pregnancy secret?
Yeah, I got another one for you, and that is the fact is that if Jesus spiritually rose from the dead, Simcha Jacobovici says that that actually he was still God then. Okay, you don't have to sweat it. He had a spiritual resurrection instead of a physical resurrection. Well, if he was still God, if he was God, would you name your kid Judas? And I don't think so. And that's what, I mean, just think about that. Jesus naming his son Judas, the very one who betrayed him. Let's go to something else. And that is the very thing that's at stake here is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And Jim Tabor says that actually Mark doesn't give us a physical resurrection. He gives us a spiritual resurrection. And so this is okay. But that's not true. Tell us why.
Well, Tabor's trying to make a distinction between an empty tomb story, which simply has the tomb empty, and an actual resurrection appearance story, which shows a physical Jesus. And so he's saying the empty tomb doesn't represent a physical resurrection, but that's bogus. And the reason it's bogus is Mark is writing, most people will put him in close to AD 70, most non-conservative scholars. Conservative scholars will date him about 10 years earlier. But that's not so important here. What's important is he writes after Paul writes. Paul writes at a time in which the Christian church is preaching a physical resurrection. We know that from 1 Corinthians 15. We know that from what the church is preaching out there in the fields that's converting people. In fact, we know it goes all the way back to the 30s because it converts Paul, who is a Pharisee. Paul has a Pharisaical view of resurrection. That's a physical resurrection. That's not
which
just
goes
a spiritual
back to the Maccabees.
Which goes back to 2 Maccabees 7. There's a wonderful story in 2 Maccabees 7. Well, actually, it's a gruesome story, but it's wonderful in making the point. And that is, you have seven sons being executed in front of their mother. They are being dismembered one at a time and bleeding to death. When it comes time for the third son to be executed, he sticks out his tongue and he sticks out his hands and basically says, "You can have these because I'm getting them back." Now, that couldn't be more graphic that there's a belief in a physical resurrection.
Yeah, also, you have to posit this thing that James, who was a skeptic all of his life, he lived with his own brother, Jesus, and was a skeptic, didn't believe in him. What did he say converted him? He saw the risen Jesus, all right? Now, you have to postulate the fact is that he somehow helped Mary, and they got the tomb out of Joseph of Arimathea's tomb and brought it over to this Talpiot tomb, and then knowing that he had the bones right there, he went out and preached the physical resurrection. That makes James an incredibly bad guy.
Either that or psychologically very schizophrenic.
Yeah. You became a Christian in your 20s. You came out of a Jewish family that you didn't believe in Jesus. Again, talk about the fact of what was the evidence that led you to believe in Jesus. What is the case, in essence, for the resurrection?
Well, there are several elements to this that if you just look at it historically, are important. For example, the first set of witnesses that we hear about are women consistently in the gospel stories. If you had the right, remember that some people are claiming, no, this isn't really a resurrection. This was invented by the early church. So you get to make the rules. If you were inventing a story, would you use women to be your first witnesses? When women in the first century do not have any witness value. They couldn't be witnesses in a court of law. You're going to try and convince the culture of a difficult concept that they have trouble accepting, and you're going to use non-witnesses to do it. Unlikely. That's the first point. The second point is, if you're inventing the story and you're using Judaism as the background, you could have had a raised Jesus who you preached, who is raised at the end along with everyone else at the general resurrection, which is what Jews believe, and simply have Jesus in charge of it at the end. Only that isn't what you get. You get a Christian innovation on Judaism. That innovation is a resurrection in the midst of history after 3 days. So if you're making the rules according to Judaism and making up the story, you could have done it with a lot less trouble, have Jesus be raised at the very end of history, saying, "It's coming, gang. He is going to be alive and he is going to be the one who judges." Only that isn't what they did. So something created that innovation. My suggestion is it's the resurrection. And then you have James and Paul, who come along. James converted, obviously, in the period right after Jesus' crucifixion. Paul within a couple of years, both of whom experience the risen Lord and who are converted as a result. And the value of that is it tells us that in the 30s, a resurrected physical Jesus was being preached and taught. So that when Tabor comes along and says, "See, Mark is written and he doesn't have a physical resurrection," and that's bogus, because the resurrection is already a given in Christianity. Everybody knows that's what Christians are teaching and preaching, so he doesn't have to mention it.
All right, next week, before the dust settled on this radical theory about the lost tomb of Jesus and finding the bones of Jesus in the box there, you've got one before the dust even settles called The Gospel According to Judas. And we're going to talk about that as well as Reading Judas, put out by Lane Pagels and Karen King from Harvard, and Pagels is from Princeton. So I hope that you'll join us as we talk about those next week.
For additional resources, log on to jashow.org. That's jashow.org.